You're listening to One in a series of presentations from the 2008 High Ed Web Conference in Springfield, Missouri.
So, good morning. My name is Paul Gilzo. I'm with the Department of Web Communications at the University of Missouri. I'll let you know this presentation usually takes about an hour and 15 minutes. We only got 45, so I'm going to have to talk a little bit faster. I'm going to have to ask you to hold your questions until the end, if you can. If you've got your laptops and you're Twittering, I've created a back channel at HEW08XSS, and if you want to, you can post your questions there, and then after the presentation, I'm going to go back tonight, post those answers up on the Ning site. So just a real quick poll, how many of you have heard of cross-site scripting? Just about everybody. Okay, how many of you have a pretty good idea of what cross-site scripting is? All right, a few more or a little bit less. How many of you actually use cross-site scripting to exploit somebody else's site? A couple, okay. The FBI would like to see you after this presentation is over. How many of you have done HTML development? Pretty much everybody? Everybody's familiar with HTML code? How many of you have done some JavaScript development? All right, good. Since some of you have heard of it but not quite really sure on what it is, I'm going to kind of start at the base and kind of work our way back up. All right, so all browsers follow what's called the same origin policy. And what that means is the content in the page has to come from the same host, the same protocol, and the same port number for content to interact with each other. And this is a good thing, because if you've got Facebook up and you've got your bank up, you don't want Facebook interacting with your bank's website, right? Okay. But you've probably all put maybe embedded YouTube videos on your pages. Some of you have done that? Okay. Well, the YouTube video doesn't live on your server, does it? No, it's out on YouTube's server. So you've actually got cross-domain content on your website. But the browser allows that because as far as it's concerned, all of that content has come from one domain. In other words, your server gave out that page with all that content, all those links, everything. So the browser says, okay, that's fine. All right, well, cross-site scripting attempts to exploit or bypass that same origin policy by injecting additional commands into any place you accept inputs. All right, so cross-site scripting is an injection attack. It usually takes the form of either HTML code, like image source or frame or something like that, or actual script tags, and then link out to somebody else's domain, somebody else's web server, and pushes over those JavaScript files. Now, cross-site scripting is not an attack against your web server. It's not an attack against your website, and for the most part, does no damage to your website. It's an attack against your users. All right? It attempts to exploit the trust that your users have for your domain. So how many of you, I mean, everybody here is higher ed, how many of you are pretty sure that if you send a link to one of your faculty members that's on your own site, how sure are you that they're going to trust that link? Pretty sure, right? Because it's their school. I mean, they trust that their school is secure. So we're going to attempt to exploit that trust that the user has for the website to trick them into going there. Because if we can get our script, as an attacker, if we can get our script to run in the context of that page, we own the page. We can do anything we want. And cross-site scripting is usually an indication of a much larger problem. Now, it can be used as an attack in and of itself, but it's also usually combined with additional attacks like cross-site request forgeries, clickjacking, lots of others. So we usually use it, attackers usually use it as a basis, a foundation, a little slip there, as a basis to launch additional attacks. All right, so how prevalent is cross-site scripting? Well, in 2006, out of 12,000 sites scanned, out of all the vulnerabilities from those 12,000 sites, almost 70% were cross-site scripting. All right, so that's a big chunk of vulnerabilities out there. All right, 2007, scanned 33,000 sites, almost 70,000 vulnerabilities, and 60% of those were cross-site scripting. So we've kind of come down a little bit through education and presentations such as this, but it's still a huge problem. All right, well, how prevalent is it in higher education? Yeah, Web App Security, which is a consulting firm that does security consulting, time period of January 1st to August of this year, of all the sites they scanned, of all the educational sites, 88% of the educational sites had either high, critical, or vulnerable exploits in their site. We just saw that 60% of those critical are cross-site scripting, so that's still a huge number of higher ed websites are vulnerable to cross-site scripting. All right, so what are some of the dangers of cross-site scripting? Again, cross-site scripting is usually just the first step in a much larger attack. Right? It's, again, trying to trick your users that trust your site into going to that page that's owned by the attacker and then maybe phishing, gathering up some information for identity theft, collecting email addresses for spamming. One of the real dangers is it's platform independent. It's completely platform independent. It doesn't matter if you're on a Mac, a Linux machine. Yeah, I kicked that. Sorry about that. It doesn't matter what platform you're on as far as an OS. It all runs within the browser. So how many of you have heard about the talks about the browser becoming the next OS? Yeah, well, that's actually kind of dangerous because it's platform independent. If everybody's got a browser and that's the next OS, well, if you find an exploit in the browser or on a page, it can spread like crazy. How many of you remember Sammy that hit MySpace a couple years ago? Yeah? All right. What was it? Over 1 million users were exploited within a couple of hours. I mean, so it spreads incredibly fast. And we don't have malware scanners on our browsers, at least not yet. That stuff can just spread like wildfire. So it spreads much, much faster. We can do JAR exploits, which are getting cleaned up. JAR is a Java file. There was actually some exploits you could do where you could launch an attack through a website, through a vulnerable cross-site scripting website, into a JAR file, and then the JAR file would pass back over that exploit back into the system to launch programs within the context of the user that's logged in. So it could actually launch your calculator as you, all through a website, all through a cross-site scripting vulnerability. All right, so huge problems. And the last is my favorite. It's whatever your devious little mind can come up with. All right, whatever you can think of, once your script is on the page, you own the page. You can record every click. You can record every keystroke. You can take them anywhere you want them to go. You can make them believe anything you want them to believe. All right, why is it so dangerous to higher education? Because people trust our sites. All right, as an example, my wife is a biology and chemistry teacher at a high school. And the other night, she's grading papers and grumbling about it. And the subject of Wikipedia came up, because every once in a while, she'll have a student who tries to use Wikipedia as a reference. I said, well, how do you handle that? Do you actually go out to every website they reference and check to make sure it's legit? And she said, no. Usually what we do is we give them a list. They're supposed to go there. Or if it's an EDU and the content looks okay, yeah, we'll trust it. But right there, people trust EDU websites. In fact, at least until recently, Google gave the EDU domain a higher page ranking because the EDU domain is locked down. Not just everybody can get one. All right? So people trust our sites, and that's why we're so incredibly important to attackers. Because if they can find an EDU that has an exploit, they can use that to trick additional users. Now you might be saying, okay, well, but my users, bulk of my users, we've trained them. They know what to look for. We've trained them as best we can. This report just came out 2 weeks ago. North Carolina State University did a study. What they did is they sat people down. They had them working on their computer, had a browser up, browsing a little bit, do some work. And every once in a while, they would send in a fake pop-up. All right? Like, everybody clicked on it. And they said, okay, something's got to be wrong. So they went back, and they said, okay, you're going to be working. You're going to have your browser up. You're going to be moving around. And occasionally, we're going to send you some fake pop-ups. All right, that's going to have malware. So you want to be really careful what you click on. And despite the warning, 63% of them, or they hit the OK button 63% of the time. Despite being warned that some of these are going to be bad, they did it anyway. So again, if somebody can get on your site through a vulnerability, people just click on everything, they're going to be able to get to your users. All right, so there's three types of cross-site scripting. First is called non-persistent or reflective, the most common, and the exploit only lives as long as the user is at that URL. All right, so again, it does nothing to your server. You won't even know anything happened unless you're looking back over the server logs. All right, so it only lasts as long as they're there, but it relies completely on social engineering. In other words, I have got to trick you, I've got to trick your users into going to that link so I can launch that exploit. All right. The second type is persistent or stored. This exploit actually gets stored somewhere in a database or some other data storage and then replayed back to everybody that comes to the web page. Much more dangerous, and it's usually common on web forums and social sites. The last is called local, and that's that JAR I was talking about. It's less likely but still dangerous. Less likely because you kind of have to know the file paths of the files you're trying to attack. You have to really know the system those people are on. All right, so I'm going to give you some examples, and then we're going to do live demos. Now, I know I drank all of my coffee that I normally drink in 4 hours in about 30 minutes, so I could talk faster. But if I am talking too fast or if I've skipped over and something's not clear, just let me know. We're going to do some. I'm just going to give you some verbal examples, and we're going to go back and do some live examples. All right, so OPA. OPA is the code name for the University of Missouri's online job application system. It's just easier to say OPA. And if I say paw print, that's what we call our single sign-on IDs. So as I go through these examples, I'll be saying those. So at our online job application system, applicants have to register. And then they store sensitive data. They store addresses, previous work history, social security numbers, phone numbers, et cetera. All the information that anybody would ever need to be able to do some identity theft. All right, Sean happens to find a reflective cross-site scripting vulnerability. And now what Sean's going to do is he's going to attempt to trick Jane into going to that URL. So maybe he says, hey, you know, I found this job. It sounds great for you. I know you're wanting to move, change jobs. It's perfect. So he sends that to her in an email or maybe IM or Twitter or something, and she heads over. Now, it's reflective, so that means the payload, the actual exploit, is in the URL. And it comes up as soon as she's there. And if she's already logged in or if she attempts to log in, because we control that page, we can gather up all that information and send it back off-site. If she's already logged in, I can grab her cookie ID. And if the site's vulnerable to cross-site request forgeries, I can take over her session and get to all her data. You look at me with blank stares. Is that making sense, or are you just really scared at this point? I am talking really fast. So you can tell me to slow down, because I got the coffee and the nerves. Well, again, we're going to do live demos, too, so you'll be able to see it even more in depth. Everybody good on reflective so far? Have a pretty good idea what it is? All right, persistent. Let's say that OPA also has a web form that's susceptible to cross-site injection. Sean finds out about this. He creates a thread, embeds that exploit in there. And typically, there are usually inflammatory statements, because what you're trying to do is get as many people to come here. So he's going to say something just really outrageous, try to get people to come. And so Jane comes over, and she views the thread. And because that injection is coming from the web server, as far as the browser's, as far as it's concerned, it's okay. It bypasses that same origin policy. And we can now send, again, all that data back to the attacker. But it's not just Jane. It's everybody. Anybody that goes to that web page is going to have the same thing happen to them over and over and over again until somebody finds out and removes that exploit. Okay, good. All right, local. Like I said, local's a little bit harder. Let's say Jane visits a compromised site that has a local-based cross-site scripting attack. The malicious JavaScript on the page is going to launch an attack against an HTML page on Jane's machine. So how many of you have noticed that a lot of programs nowadays, their help files are actually HTML pages? Yeah, all of Windows Help, all those. Yep, everything. A lot of pages now are HTML pages, those help files. So all you have to do is find one of those that are vulnerable, and if you know the path, you can actually have the browser launch those pages, inject into that page, and the dangerous part about this is that page is on the local machine and runs within the context of the user logged in. So now the script is running as you and can do anything else in your computer that you can do. Again, very dangerous, but less likely because you have to know what platform they're on, you have to know the file paths, etc. Still dangerous, just less likely. All right, any questions before we actually do the live demos? Because I know that's what everybody's here for. Any questions at all? No? Okay, I will warn you that penetration testing on somebody else's website is a legal gray area. It is currently illegal in Germany. In the U.S., it has not been tested. So I strongly recommend that you do not go out and start trying to do this on other people's websites. All right, the websites I'm going to show you have either had the exploit published and the vendor notified for well over a year, or I have talked to the owner and gotten an okay. I don't see Jason in here. Or not. Jason Woodward from Cornell. No, he's not in here. Okay. He said I could show this. All right, so just to let you know. All right, so I'm going to go over to my Windows. Oh, let's hope this is working now. If not, I guess I'll have to flip back. Okay. How many of you would probably trust a link from NBC.com? NBC.com is a pretty well-known website, right? All right, so let's head over to NBC.com then. Let me pull up NBC search. There we go. nothing. I don't know why that menu's not going away. There we go. All right, so this is what happens. An attacker will go in and do some reconnaissance. And the reconnaissance he's going to do, or she's going to do, is going to try to find out how the web application handles information. So they usually use some string with different characters and some type of keyword to help them find that information when the page comes back. All right, if you look in your server logs and you see ABX, I visited. Okay, and I did do a quick little survey before I came here to the conference, and 6 out of 10 of you had cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. Now, if I found your website and it had a cross-site scripting, I'll be contacting you before the conference is over to share that information with you. But I just wanted to get a feel. Is it really as bad as all the stats look? Yeah, it kind of is. All right, so let's go ahead and hit search and see what happens. Okay, so it comes back, and this is pretty typical. It says search results for, and then the string I put. You see that all the time. You hit, you know, you search at Google, it comes back and says, here's what you searched for. All right, well, what we want to do is we want to see what actually came back in the source. Now, can everybody see that, or do I need to make it a little bigger? Is that good in the back? Okay, so I'm going to say, all right, find that ABX. All right, so it looks like it's putting it in JavaScript, but it's escaped the quote, so I, you know, maybe I could try to play and escape the escape and try to get through there, but I don't know. That doesn't look too good. So let's see what else is in here. There's that one. URL encoded everything, so I probably can't do anything there, but can everybody see that? What did they do? What's that? They did a comparison, but what did they leave? When they put the data back into the page, the information, they didn't do anything, did they? They just put it back in verbatim. All right, that's the first sign. I see that and I'm like, ah, wait a second. Okay, let's try something. All right, so I'm going to go back here. And notice the URL still. It just says app search. So what method for this form is it using? What's that? Get or post, right? Because there's nothing in the URL. I did a search. There's nothing in the URL. All right, so let's try this. Let's say, all right, script alert 1. Be real basic. And let's see what happens. All right, so let's look in the page source. And let's see if we can find that. Oh, this might take a while. There's probably lots of ones. Use something a little bit better. I should search for script. Yeah, let's try script. Should have used a better keyword in there. Ah, there it is. So again, they put it in verbatim, and so I was able to inject that code. All right, now as an attacker, though, I still have a little problem, because can I send them a URL? Oops, there it is, to this page and actually run my attack? I mean, there's some JavaScript you could do. If I could find another site that's exploited, I could have it post the data over here. But I can't just send them to mbc.com at this point and have the attack run, because there's nothing in the URL. I haven't been able to put it in. How many of you use Firebug and web developer in Firefox? You ever messed around with a forms piece? All right, what's one of the things you can do with the forms piece? Yep, you can change the post to get. So that's the next thing you do. You go, all right, I'm going to change the post to get, and I'm going to try that same attack. And if I'm lucky, I'll get it in the URL. Attack runs again, and what's in the URL? Oops, scoot over here so you can see it. Oops, there it is. Now I can post that to a user and get them to come here. Now I know some of you might be thinking, ooh, a pop-up. Ooh, scary. There's more. This is all you need. Once you know you can do this, you know you can do anything. And I'll show you in a second. But you can see how dangerous this is? Now, post isn't the answer either. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to change everything always to post. Because all I have to do is find another site that's vulnerable, create a link to your website, and behind that link, put JavaScript that'll post the data first. So again, just because you change everything to post, it doesn't mean you're safe. All right, I'm going to show you another one. And this is Cornell. Everybody familiar with Cornell? Again, a higher education institution, very well known, high level of trust among users. All right, we're going to do the same type of attack. I'm going to go up here to their search bar. Now, I will tell you that Pages is not vulnerable. People is. Okay, I'm going to use the same little string. Tell it to search. And then, well, it's kind of hard to see. You might not be able to see it, but I look up at the search box. And can you see what happened? Anybody see it? My string is kind of hanging out there. Let's find it. And do you see what happened? Let me pull it up here a little bit higher. I remember buffer overflows from a couple years ago? Yeah. Okay. This is a real simple, very reduced explanation, but essentially in a buffer overflow, you're trying to overflow the little area that's contained for your code and trying to spill out into another area where your code can execute. And that's kind of what we've done here. We've said he's just put in, or she has just put in verbatim what we put into the search feature. And so what I did is I got a quote there, and that has essentially ended what should be in value. And now all my stuff is spilling out or overflowing into the rest of the page. All right, so I'm going to show you another one. This one's a little worse. I got this one saved, so I didn't have to type it all out. But you can do this kind of stuff. As it loads. Same exact attack. Page defacement. All right, in this case, you can't, I'm sorry, the screen's kind of small, can't quite see it, but I have loaded in a JavaScript file. You can see it up here. I got a JavaScript source from XSSED.net. XSSED is a group that records sites that have cross-site scripting vulnerabilities and then works with the vendors to correct those. And so that's another thing I always do. I never use my own scripts because I don't want them coming back to me getting mad, because if they go to there, there's an automatic warning. If you are a website owner, here's what you need to know. And then they start working with you. But I can control the page. I have got my script to load. I now own the page. Completely. It is mine. I can do. I mean, if you've done JavaScript development, you know once you've got access to the DOM, you own it. You can do anything you want. Yes?
Just a little clarification. This is only going to work for the person who sends that link to.
Correct. This one.
This one. No other users are vulnerable. You really haven't affected the web page at all. You've only affected the web page for that one user.
Exactly. Yes. And that is reflective cross-site scripting. Reflective is only for the user that goes there. The website itself, not affected at all. And again, if you don't check your logs, you'll never know it happened. Like literally, you won't have any idea.
Until they call you up and say.
Exactly. Everybody kind of see what's going on with this? When I'm down to 15 minutes left, could somebody yell? Okay, just want to make sure. All right, let's do now a stored. Let me launch this. All right, so this is kind of just a little example, real basic, kind of like Twitter. You put in a little comment, you hit leave a comment, and it posts the previous comments. Okay, so this is a persistent demo. Again, we can do the same thing. We can say, all right, start out with the same little keystrokes, little keywords in here. Oops, I need space in between there too. Leave my comment. It shows up down here. Check the source. There we go. Again, what's this application doing? Spitting it out verbatim again, right? So what am I most likely going to be able to do? Inject scripts in there. All right, so let's try that. Did I spell it right? Yeah, okay. There we go. And because it's a script tag, it doesn't even show up. But I could probably inject other stuff, too. I could probably put something right after the script tag to make it look like something showed up. But the real danger here is it is live no matter what. So if I open up, you know, IE, maybe. There we go. and I go there. Boom. All right, every user that comes to this page, we can do it in Opera. Now it wants to run slow, sorry about that. There we go, same page. Every user that comes to this page is now going to have that exploit run against them. Okay, let me give you an even more concrete example of how dangerous this is. As part of web communications, one of our jobs is to evaluate other websites for the different colleges and departments on our campus. About a year ago, the student information systems, and Jason, don't go back and tell them, my colleagues here, that I'm telling on them. They came to us and they said, hey, we're getting ready to launch this degree audit system where our students can go in and they can evaluate how far along they are in their degree. They can see what classes they've taken, what classes they need, and they can interact with their faculty and their advisors about their degree program. As I was going through it, I found a persistent cross-site scripting exploit inside of a student area where the students goes that faculty and advisors had access to. To bring home the point, what I did is I injected it, had them log in as a faculty member. When the script ran, I had it take out the page and present a screen back that said, your session has timed out, you need to log back in. Please enter your paw print and password. They enter their paw print and password, hit submit, my JavaScript catches it, send it off-site, restores the page, and removes the script. And because it's persistent, who does it happen to? Every faculty member and advisor that comes to that page. And so now what have I done? I got the usernames and passwords of faculty. So think about it, an attacker, how easy is it to get a freshman's username and password? Simple. Yeah, password, you know, it's simple. Okay, so they don't have access to anything, but they have access to this. So I get that, I find this exploit, put my injection there, faculty, advisors come in, now I've got faculty and advisors' passwords, and now I've got access to a whole bunch more. I've got access to the VPN, I've got access to the internet, I've got access to other students' grades, I've got access to all kinds of stuff. Making sense? All right. Some of you probably remember Obama's website got hit, Hillary Clinton's website got hit, all kinds of websites have been hit with this. But we're even more dangerous because we have such large user populations. We got federal regulations, you know, FERPA. This stuff gets out, it's really bad. All right, so let me flip back over to my presentation. So what can we do to protect our applications? And where am I time-wise? Am I good? Anybody know? What time is it? Quarter after? Okay, about 15 minutes? Okay. Well, first thing you need to do is put on your tinfoil hats. And you need to be very, 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 very paranoid. Very paranoid. You can trust no one. I don't care where your input is coming from, you don't trust it. Everything coming into your application is an attack. That's how you have to think. You just have to do it that way. Because let's say you're getting data from a database. How do you know the data in that database is okay? How do you know that somebody else hasn't put data in there from some other application that uses that database? And now you're going to get it and then relay it back out to your users. You can't trust anything as an input. Everything is a possible attack. In addition, you use layers, lots and lots and lots of layers, a military of a defense in depth. Because what you're trying to do, you're not going to stop the attacker. If an attacker wants to get in, he or she is going to get in eventually. It's just a matter of time and energy and money. You can't stop them, but you can make it really, really hard. And what you don't want to be is the low-hanging fruit, the easy site to attack, because that's what they want. They don't want to put a lot of energy into it. They just want to get some simple ones and then go to the next site. So you're going to use lots and lots of layers. Some layers that you can use. One is input filtering. It's also known as blacklisting. So you can go in, you can say, okay, well, if I see a less than symbol, I'm just going to remove it. But what's the problem with doing that as a single defense? Exactly. There's totally legitimate reasons why you might want to allow some of that input. In addition, how many different character sets are there? Lots of different character sets. So if I can somehow manipulate your page to allow UTF-7, well, then I can inject UTF-7 less than. And now I'm back to where I was again. All right. Blacklisting is all, it's just like chasing your tail. You're just going to keep going and going and going, and you're never going to be able to keep up. It's okay as one part of a multiple-layered system, but it can't be the only one that you use. But next one, the one that I stress highly, is input validation. You have to input, you have to validate that input that you're receiving. So if you're asking for a social security number, what should be in a social security number? Numbers and how many numbers?
Nine.
No more, no less, all numbers. So that's all you allow. You say, okay, if it's longer than nine, the character length is longer than nine, spit it out. If it's not all numbers, spit it out. For everything that you can possibly validate, do. All right? And I had a user once who I injected through a drop-down list. Because, you know, if you've used the web developer toolbar, you can change those drop-down lists to text inputs. So how do you do that? I have a drop-down list. Doesn't matter. You can't control the client side once it's gone from your server. The user controls it. So even those, you have to validate. At least with a drop-down list, you should have an array or a list of possible values and then compare them against them. So input validation. The next one is output encoding. So for those symbols that you should allow, maybe like a less than, especially if it's like in a math thing, then when you output that data back to the browser, encode everything into their HTML entities. Because if it's an ampersand GT colon, I can't do anything with that as an attacker. Because it's not actual executable code, it's just a symbol. The next one you can do is called an intrusion detection system. It's also known as a web application firewall. There was some controversy with those for a while because people thought they were the be-all, end-all of your solution, and they're not. They're just another layer, but they are handy. I do want to show you a quick demo of one so you have a better idea of what it does. Let me get back to my Firefox. Now, this one happens to be for PHP. It's called PHP IDS. It's an intrusion detection system, and what it's going to do is it's going to evaluate all the posts, all the gets, and try to determine if an attack is coming in, and then it scores it. So I'm going to put an attack here real quick so you can just kind of see. And here it says, all right, injection found. List out the rules and then scores each of the rules that attack has violated. Down at the bottom, it gives me an overall impact. Now, that's all it does. It just evaluates the incoming data and says, okay, this is what I found. These are the rules that it has violated that are common with attacks, and here's a score. From there, you can do whatever you want. You can say, okay, you know, anything more than 10 is a definite attack, and I'm going to block you as best you can. Or you can simply store it in a session and say, okay, well, maybe you weren't really, but if you bump over 25 total, then I'm going to kick you out. But again, it's just another layer, because if an attacker tries to inject and hits this and you're blocking them, well, now they've got to go get another IP, and then they come back, and they've got to get through all your other layers. Again, it's just more layers on top of each other. Something else that you can do is called tidy output. Anybody heard of HTML Purifier? A couple of you? It simply takes input, HTML input, evaluates it, and then purifies it back to some doc type. Give you a quick example there of that. Bring up my bookmarks again. There it is. All right, so let's say I've got div ID equals blah, and then put an end quote, text, and then I end it with a paragraph. Really bad HTML, right? You know, I didn't start it with a quote, but I've ended it with a quote. You know, I'm ending the div with a paragraph instead. I can say, all right, you know, I want this to be XHTML1 transitional. I'll submit that, and HTML Tidy will take it, convert it back to this. So if you've got stuff, if you've got characters you need people to enter, or you've got maybe a section where you're allowing them to do some basic HTML, you can use this to at least make sure that what they've entered is valid HTML, because if it gets a double quote in there, you know, I'm trying to break out of that double quote area, it's not going to allow it. It's going to correct that and fix it. Yes? I'm sorry, say that again? Yes. Yes. At least for the PHP one. I know there's a .NET one. I don't know about any of the other languages, but they have an offshoot for .NET as well. All right. Any other questions? There's also anti-SAMI. Anti-SAMI was born out of the SAMI attack, the MySAMI attack on MySpace. It is kind of like the HTML purifier. Again, it's allowing... HTML to come in and actually be valid, and then making sure there's no attacks embedded. Again, another piece that you can add, another layer that you can add to that security. I actually finished. Wow. So I was a little fast. I apologize for that. So I think how many? We got 5 minutes left? 5 minutes. So five questions? If any questions? Yes. Lots of regular expressions, tied to the output. It's hard. That is a hard one when you're trying to allow them to do actual HTML. And that's why the BB code was so popular, because then you could convert it and you could kind of control it. That's even injectable, but it's not easy. It is difficult. You just have to make sure that what they're putting in is what you want to allow them to do. And I definitely check out Anti-SAMI, because that is specifically what that is designed to do. Yes. And that is exactly why they do it that way. Because it's easier to say, okay, if I'm going to format my HTML this way, then I know what I should be getting, and then I can convert it over to HTML. You got a question? Good question. Ooh, I don't know about log files, because I'm not a sysadmin. There are tools, though, that you can use. One is the XSSme. What this will do is it'll run full collection of cross-site scripting attacks against every form possible in a page, and then give you those results. It's a little Firefox extension. There's also something called Hackbar. Whoops, wrong one. Right here. Can't find a good spot to click on to open it up. Oh, there. So not only will it do cross-site scripting, it'll also do MS SQL, MySQL, but also doing codings so that you can attack tag design. Again, you're not supposed to tag anybody else's site, only your sites. With your system admin approval. Yes?
What day were you doing that?
What day was I doing what?
When you were looking, so that I can look at my logs.
It was over the last 2 weeks, essentially. Again, if I found one, I'll contact you for sure. And then I'll get you guys. I know there's tools to search in logs. I just don't do system administration, so I don't usually have to go back over the logs. That's true, too. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not real well-versed in the logs, because I'm lucky enough I don't have to mess with any system administration. Yes, exactly. Yeah, SQL injection is even worse. And the same strings that you saw me using is used in SQL injection, because you usually do your qualifiers with double quotes or single quotes. But at least with SQL servers, you know, most of those now, they've got some type of binding or encapsulation. So the vendors have tried to lessen that attack, but they're still extremely dangerous. In fact, I found one site, and I won't say who it was, that actually dumped out the SQL statements in their comments as you ran searches. So now you got table names, field names, all that stuff. ClickJag is a whole other thing that lays, you do cross-site scripting, you lay another div on top of a page, you make the bottom page translucent, and then put things for the user to click on, but they're actually clicking on the stuff below. Yeah, so you can bring up their bank site in the background, they click transfer funds, even though they think they're clicking something else, and they hit, you know, submit, and they think they're posting a comment on Twitter, but they're actually just transferring money to you. Yeah, clickjacking is fun, too. Web server firewalls, our firewalls. Again, you can use it as a layer, but I wouldn't depend on it 100%. It depends on the web server's firewall, because it doesn't analyze the SSL traffic, does it? Does it? Okay. It's just another layer that you can use. I wouldn't trust it because, again, you're never going to fully stop somebody from attacking you and getting through if they are determined. You can only make it cumbersome. Yes?
This question's already been asked. Some has already been answered, but what what is the most bulletproof, easiest solution to implement at this point? Is it like a purifier type solution? Or is there, I mean, what is going to give you the most bang?
I'd say output encoding. I had to just name one. If you can only do one today, I'd say output encoding. Because at least then you're limiting a big bulk. In PHP, it's just a function. You take my string and then convert it into HTML entities. I don't remember what it is in .NET off the top of my head, but yes. Yeah, it just correct. Oh, HTML and code.net. Another thing is, if you're going to the WordPress thing today, I love open source stuff. I do. I really do. I really, really do. But some of that stuff, especially WordPress, is really bad about these injections. And I don't want to ding against them, but you've got people who aren't real, not I don't want to say real programmers, that aren't security experts necessarily programming this stuff, and they haven't thought about these things. So if you install WordPress and then start plugging in all these different plugins and modules and not checking the code, you have no idea what you just allowed. At 2.6.2, it's solid right now, but 2.6.1 had a remote injection vulnerability where I could take over the admin password and then lock everybody out. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad product, just make sure you stay on top of the updates. I mean, WordPress MU, which is supposed to be a little bit more secure, just came out with a whole bunch of cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. So yeah, one of the problems with open source is that all the attackers can open it up and take a look. So again, it's a great product to use, just make sure you stay on top of the updates and you harden it up as much as possible.
That's all we got for today.
Thank you.
For more presentations from the 2008 Higher Ed Web Conference, visit highedweb.org/2008. Or sign up for our podcasting feed at highedweb.org/podcast.xml.